You've tuned to The Turley Frequency, starring your host, Kevin Turley, with guest stars Mike Romano and Reed Hodges, and special guest stars, the members of the FCC, whom we respect respectfully. Now, time to get tuned into The Frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Turley Frequency.
Good morning and welcome. Welcome to Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Today on the show we meet Philip Campbell, historian and author of several books, including The Story of the Church and a four-volume Story of Civilization. Yes, we talk history with Philip in the next segment. Top of the hour, we pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and you are invited to join us. Yes, feel free to text me your prayer requests on 251-928-2111. The lines are open for you right now. In the final segment today, we hear the latest news, and there seems to be a lot of it about, from the world of ufology with Mr. Bill Murphy, our very own resident expert in all things extraterrestrial. Okay, with all this good stuff, let's get this show on the road. Yes, hello and welcome to Wednesday's edition of the Turley Frequency. I do hope your Wednesday is going well in this wonderful month of July, which, as we've discovered, is dedicated to the precious blood of Jesus. And we'll be talking more about that in due course, no doubt, as this month unravels. I'm really glad to be with you this morning, and I'm also really glad to report that I had an unbroken and very sound night's sleep. I know I've been belly aching these last couple of days about helicopters, police helicopters overhead as I wake up and wondering what is going on. Well, last night I slept like a baby and there was no sound except probably my snoring. That was the only sound to be heard in this part of the world, that's for sure. And I was also a bit sleepy yesterday, a little bit sort of, you know, when you wake up at 3 o'clock and the rest of the day you're running on fumes, really, right? You haven't had enough sleep. You are running a bit, certainly when you get to my age anyway. So I missed mentioning what the great feast was yesterday, and it was the feast of St. Benedict. Yeah, St. Benedict, a name which easily trips off the tongue, but actually is a rather obscure saint in some ways. We all know about Benedictine monasteries and such like, and even maybe have heard of the rule of St. Benedict. I'm not sure we know a lot about him, though, in real terms. But then it suddenly dawned on me that on Monday we had had a real live Benedictine monk on the show. Do you remember? Father Boniface Hicks. And he was talking to us about his new book on the consecration, 33-day consecration to Jesus through Mary. And I'm sure whenever he was booked, it was just a random date that was plopped down and it wasn't deliberately related to St. Benedict, but there's nothing without coincidence. So it was kind of interesting that we have a Benedictine popping up just before we celebrate that great feast day. And it's funny, I was walking to Mass this morning through the park, thinking about you all, as I do. And I was thinking about the conversation I'd had with Father Boniface. Do you remember? If you haven't heard it, go back and listen to it. He was an interesting man. Because I don't know about you, this whole idea of consecrations to the Immaculate Heart, to the Sacred Heart, you know, we need a little bit of help sometimes. Just understanding the finer points of theology around them. I think we all understand the gist of it, right? But what does it actually mean? And what is its effect, more importantly? What difference does it make to you and me in our daily lives, our daily Christian lives? That's a question that keeps popping into my mind. And you remember with Father Boniface, we talked about this 33-day consecration. And during the conversation, it suddenly dawned on me Well, before it dawned on me, the thinking when I was looking at his material was that it was something for an individual, for a soul, right? Each soul consecrates themselves to the 33-day consecration. But then, as Father Boniface pointed out, well, it could be done by a couple, husband and wife. Could be done by a family. Could certainly be done by a parish and a parish group, or even a prayer group within a parish, a rosary group, prayer group of some sort or other. And Father Boniface told us about the religious communities, Benedictines, I think, or maybe been Cistercian, I can't remember, one or other, who have a four-year rolling program of consecrations to the Immaculate Heart, maybe Sacred Heart. And they use, one of the years, they use Father Boniface's 33-day consecration book. All good, right? You're thinking, where's this all leading? Well, it suddenly dawned on me, what if we did that on this radio show? That's right. What if we consecrated this radio show? Now, let's just define what this radio show is. This radio show is, yes, it's me. Yes, it's Reed, Mike, Michelle, everybody working on it. Absolutely. Sherry, Shannon, everybody. That's part of who this radio show is. Correct. But it's also you. It's you, the listener, right? It would be a very strange radio show without an audience, right? It'd be me talking to myself. And you know that's the first sign of madness. So we're in this together. The radio show is you and me and everybody associated with it. All our guests, all our contributors, all our prayer warriors, all those who send in intentions, all those who ask for prayers. This is the radio show. So it got me wondering, what would happen if we consecrated this radio show to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, or to the Sacred Heart of Jesus through the Immaculate Heart of Mary? What would happen? Would it make any difference? What do you think? Text me, 251-928-2111, or phone me, 888-928-0881. I'd love to know what you think. Now, as far as I know, I have never, ever come across a radio show that did this live on air. I've never heard it. Now, it may have happened. I don't listen to all Catholic radio across all the known universe. But what if we did it live on air for 33 days? And everybody who was listening, everybody who accidentally tuned in, whether you're Catholic, practicing, lapsed, collapsed, whether you're Protestant, evangelical, Orthodox, or whether you're Muslim, Hindu, Jewish, Rastafari, Shinto. I'm running out of religions. You know what I'm saying. What does it matter? When you're turning that dial somewhere and you pick up this radio station, it doesn't matter who you are, really. What would it mean for us to be consecrated for those 33 days? Now, if you have just tuned into this station and you've just tuned into this program, and I suspect many of you are good Catholics, and it's great to have you here. We love having you here. Anybody who listens on a regular basis, we love you. You're why we're here. And if you like the show, it's even better, right? Even better. But if you've just tuned in and you are a Catholic, or you were brought up a Catholic, and maybe you're not a Catholic anymore, I have one thing to say to you. Welcome home. Because this is your home. It's your radio home. I hope as well it's a portal to somewhere. But for now, it's just your home. And you never maybe have to call in. You'll never text the show. You'll never communicate. You'll just listen, and that's okay for the moment. And we just let the Holy Spirit do whatever the Holy Spirit does, which is blow here and there and everywhere. And he knows what he's about. But I repeat, welcome home. This is where you need to be. This is where we want you to be. Now, yesterday I was doing an interview for an article I'm writing about World Youth Day. And World Youth Day, as you know, is coming up at the start of August, I think it is, end of July, start of August in Portugal. And the Pope will go and visit, and all the young people will have a wonderful time. I went to a number of World Youth Days way, way back in the distant past. And they really were life-altering and life-changing. And I'll talk a little bit more about that maybe on another day, closer to the time when we're having World Youth Days. But I was very struck by something which this man I was interviewing said about his trip to the World Youth Day back in the earlier part of this century. And he said that he had... I said, were you a practicing Catholic? He said, no. He said, I'd had my first Holy Communion, aged 8. I was now 18 and there hadn't been any communions in between. It's pretty collapsed, right? Pretty lapsed. But his mother, and I know this is a constant theme on this show, his mother badgered him to go to World Youth Day. He was in Sydney, Australia, and he was living in London. And you know what he thought? He thought, free holiday. He was 18. He had just flunked all his exams. He wasn't going to university. He wasn't doing anything. And his very devout Catholic mother was giving him grief, as they say in London, which was meaning he was making his life difficult. She kept nagging him. Come on, do something with your life. Look, why don't you go to this World Youth Day in Sydney? And all he could think about was Australia and thinking it'd be sunny, it'll be warm, surf. Free holiday. So he now he had to get some money from the parish as well, and he said he was very touched because the parish came together, and it's your typical parish, and this is the same the world over, the Catholic world over. I don't know about you, most parishes, 80% of the people are over 80 or over 70 at least, right? They seem to be anyway, certainly during the week. And they got together, all these little old ladies, and they're mostly little old ladies, some are little old men as well. And they had a collection so that he could go to Sydney to experience World Youth Day. So he went. And he went. He didn't go with the right spirit. In fact, he went with the totally wrong spirit, right? He went with a spirit that was literally just, what can I get out of this? What can I get? I can get a free holiday. It's all I want. He went with 72 people from the diocese he was in here in England, and he wanted nothing to do with them. They were people he wouldn't associate with, you know. He was just going to have a whole day. They can do their praying, go into Mass, adoration, do all that. That's your thing. Me, I'm just going to enjoy the weather. I'm going to enjoy looking at Australia, kangaroos, koala bears, whatever. He even said that he had a bit of a, not exactly a fight, but a sort of a tug of war with one of the youth leaders on these pilgrimages. If you know, if you go on these sorts of things, you'll often have an adult with you, with a priest as well, maybe a nun, who's kind of shepherding you through things. And they often collect things, especially for young people, like passports, identification documents and stuff. So they keep them safe. So nobody loses their passport away in the middle of Australia or whatever. So one day, one of the leaders of this youth group was going around collecting the passports, you know, just to keep them safe. And this man was saying, why do you want my passport? He said, I'm 18. I'll look after my own passport. And that sort of, that little vignette sums up his attitude. He was there, but he wasn't there. So anyway, he went. And, put it this way. He came up with a wonderful quote, which is going to go straight into the article. And he said, before World Youth Day, I was one way. After World Youth Day, I was another way. And in between was him. Now you know who he is. Our risen Lord. The reason we're all here, right? His story, and I don't think he realizes just how important it is, his story is a real miracle of grace. I've just described to you the kind of 18-year-old that went to Australia, hardened in sin, hardened in attitude, believing in nothing, out for what he can get, selfish, self-centered, self-obsessed, maybe, I don't know. And he came back totally transformed. I said to him, your mother must have thought it was the best money she ever spent. He agreed. To this day, she thinks it's the greatest money she ever spent. And it's like 15 years after it, right? So for all you mums out there, keep praying. It's going to be okay. Don't worry. But he came back. Now, what happened to him out there? I said, well, what was it? Can you give me one particular incident, something that particular that happened to you during that time? And he describes something which, again, on the surface, should not have had any impact on him. Now, it was the Holy Mass, but the group he was in, and you get this on World Youth Day, right? You're part of a large group, and you move around different churches, different places to sleep, different places to eat, and also different places to worship communally, because there's a lot of groups, a lot of different language groups, so you can't have all the English in with the Germans and the Spanish and the Portuguese. Nobody would understand anything, so they tend to kind of corral you into language groups. And his group were going to this church to celebrate Mass. The priest leading them was going to say Mass. And as it turned out, the church couldn't accommodate them. It was probably too busy, it was too full, overbooked, whatever. So what did they do? They went to a hotel. And there was no room in the hotel whereby they could actually have Mass. So what did they do? They had Mass in a corridor, a hotel corridor. Think about that. And somehow during that Mass, which is still a Mass, body, blood, soul, and divinity becomes real on that altar by the office of the priest. That changed his life. That and a very, very good confession, I have to say. Either shortly before or shortly after, I can't remember which, but sacramental confession and the Eucharist in that hotel corridor changed this young man's life. Now, religious phenomena, religious enthusiasm is always something to be guarded against, right? A lot of spiritual writers write about this. Because we can be very enthusiastic about something. We come back from a pilgrimage, or we've just been to a prayer meeting, or we've just been to a wonderful papal mass or something, and we get all excited, right? But the real proof of the pudding is, does it last? Well, this young man yesterday, or he's not that young, he's in his 30s now. That young man, he said to me, I am still living through the effects, the influence of that World Youth Day. It's almost like his faith was turbocharged. Nuclear explosion, whichever sort of graphic image you want to use, and the effects are still being felt to this day. But here's the coda to this story, something to make all you mothers out there think. Now, we get a lot of mothers, they phone in during the Divine Mercy, rightly so, and they're worried about their son. It's often their son more than their daughter, but often their son, is he going to be okay? Is he going to come back to the faith? And I say, of course, don't worry, don't worry. You're praying for him. All prayers get answered. Don't worry. Think of St. Monica. She had a heavier hill to climb in terms of St. Augustine than you do. But anyway, this young man's mother prayed for him. He went to World Youth Day, and he is still living out the effects of that experience. He's a father of, I think, 4 or 5 children. I've met his wife. He's a lovely person. He lives his faith totally. He is totally committed to evangelizing young people. That's what he does every day. And guess what? In the World Youth Day that's coming up, guess who's speaking at it? Yeah, the same young man who reluctantly went 15 years ago. So, be of good cheer. Now, when we come back, we will be speaking to Philip Campbell. He's an author and a historian. And he's going to put us right on civilization. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Welcome back to the Turley Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. It's very, very good to have your company this Wednesday. Stay tuned. We've got some interesting stuff coming up. Now, my next guest is a historian, an author, but whereas most historians seem to specialize in one period, he writes about the whole history of civilization, in fact. He is Philip Campbell, who has a bachelor's degree in European history from Ave Maria University. And he appears often on the host of media outlets, including EWTN, Ave Maria Radio, and now on this show. And if that wasn't enough, he's also an instructor at Homeschool Connections and previously served two terms as mayor of Howell, Michigan. But he's also an author of several books, including The Story of the Church and the four-volume Story of Civilization series. And he has also contributed and edited a number of books and wrote two history textbooks. And I think as well, he also started his own press. We'll hear all about that, I'm sure, as well. Now, it's timely we speak to him after the Feast of St. Benedict, as Ave Maria Press published his The Church and the Dark Ages, 430 to 1027, St. Benedict, Charlemagne, and the Rise of Christendom. Sounds good, right? And its author joins me down the line this morning. Philip, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Hey, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Now, I was very much endeared to you immediately when I looked at your website today, Philip, because you were calling all history nerds, and I'm a bit of a history nerd. I love history, so I thought, this is my sort of guy. But you're an unusual historian, to say the least, as you've probably just heard me say, because most historians I know, those that teach in academia and so forth, they're very, very precise to let you know which periods they are specialist in, and they are virtually of no opinion and no interest in any other period. You go the opposite way. You seem to be interested in the whole of history, right?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's accurate to call me a historian because I don't have a PhD. I think academic historians might take umbrage at it. I think of myself more as a historical promoter, someone who wants to encourage Catholics to get more engaged in the study of history, because our faith is so historic and so much of it is grounded in these traditions that go back centuries or thousands of years. So you're right, I kind of take a broad approach, and people always ask me, what's my favorite period? I guess I started as a medievalist, but as I've studied more, I just, every period of history is interesting to me, and every period has something to teach.
I mean, I couldn't agree more with you, Philip. I'm one of those people that's like a gadfly. I bounce around different periods and have particular interests and no interests, because I see it all sort of joined up. But give me some insight into, regardless of period, what is the fascination for us, for the world, with history? What is the fascination?
Well, history has to do with our collective memory as either a church, a nation, the human species, right? It's our memory of where we've been. And memory really is identity. If you were to wake up tomorrow and you'd lost all your memory, you didn't know anything that happened to you, you would have no identity, right? So memory is our identity. And our fascination with history has to do with understanding where we have come from and where we are going and what our identity is. It helps us to make sense of who we are in a bigger context, in society, in the human story, or in the Catholic Church. So I think that's why there's a fascination with history, because it gives us some grounding outside of just the little events of our own existence and helps us to situate ourselves in this bigger context of the human story. But sadly, I think a lot of people, when they look at history, it's so they look at it like so overwhelming. There's so much of it. There's so many places. There's so many dates. And a lot of people just don't know where to start. Or they just treat it as something that would be nice to learn, but they don't feel like they have the time for it. Or as you said, they pick up something that's too academic and it's too specialized and it doesn't really give them a big picture or help them enter into anything that's rewarding, So I think we're simultaneously fascinated by it, but people are also intimidated by the challenge of digging into it.
Yeah, I mean, I've never had the intimidation. In fact, like you probably, I can get lost in history a little bit. Do you know what I mean? I sometimes find the past much more comforting than the present, and certainly prospects for the future. But the other thing which is in the background to all of this, Philip, is that history is not a settled science, shall we say. It's very contentious, especially today, right?
Yes, it is very contentious because if we can go back to something that's often quoted from Orwell, that if he who controls the past controls the present. If our history is our identity, then our view of our identity is going to be shaped by how we perceive the past. And it's not a hard science. It's not a hard science like physics or mathematics. It's one of the humanities. And because we're dealing with human beings, and I think this is why I love history, because we're dealing with human beings and their free will, and there's almost an infinite variety of things that can happen. I'm always being surprised when I'm studying history. I'll read some story and think, oh my goodness, I've never heard something like that before. Just the capability of people to do different things, to make different decisions in different, I mean, certainly you see patterns over time. You know, we know that there's various kind of rules of thumb for studying history. And if we're looking at archaeology or something like that, there's obviously disciplines for how you study these things. But in terms of the big picture, it can be contentious because it's not just what happened, but it's what does it mean? Like, how do we interpret what this means for us today? And that can vary depending on people's ideology. And so it is very contentious. In the United States, it's very contentious right now about how do we understand our own history. There's kind of two schools of thought of, like, should Americans celebrate our history and our accomplishments, or is it something we have to be sorry for and apologize for? Or maybe it's a combination of both. And so these are very contentious things even today.
Would you say, Philip, that history can ever be objective?
Oh, that's a tough one. Good question, though. Not in the way that we expect mathematics to be objective. You know, I think it can be unbiased. I think we can approach it without bias, but there's always going to be a degree of subjectivity because we're always having to interpret things that we weren't there to witness. You know, when I'm reading accounts of some medieval battle, you know, I mean, I wasn't there to see it. I don't have all the firsthand information. Nobody does. We're trying to reconstruct something from the past based on other people's fallible recollections and what we dig up in the ground. And there's always going to be a bit of subjectivity. I do think we can be unbiased, though. I mean, I try to write, I wrote a book on the Reformation, Heroes and Heretics of the Reformation, which, you know, we wanted to portray we wanted to get away from kind of like the Protestant narrative of the Reformation. But at the same time, I don't just want to replace a Protestant bias with a Catholic bias, you know, like that's not very much help. So I tried to write it with like looking at, okay, I'm going to present the Catholic viewpoint, but I'm also not going to shy away from discussing the problems or the villains on the Catholic side, you know, and just got to show what happened. And I think that's when people really can open up to history, when they realize you're not trying to sell them something. You're just trying to tell a story and have people understand.
But I guess as well, I mean, you're making me think, Philip, that let's take the Reformation, which is, you know, being fought over by historians, be they Catholic, Protestant or whatever, you know, one way or another. We've got the likes of Bellick, for example, who's written some wonderful mm-hmm. histories of the Reformation, but, you know, he plays it from his angle. And then you've got Fox's Books of the Martyrs and all the rest of it on the other side,
oh, yeah.
backwards and forwards, you know. But the way, is there a way of, we never really get to total objective standard, but situating it within a historical span or a panorama even is a way in which to understand it. Because the other thing about history, I'm sure we'd agree, is that no historical event stands in isolation from others.
Right. Yeah, you focus on one thing and then you find that it's interconnected to other things. And there's just this endless web of causality that goes back to the beginning of human history, and nobody can possibly take it all in. I mean, I think at a certain point we have to come to a consensus about what happened when you talk about taking the panorama view, you know, otherwise it, you know, we don't want to get stuck in some epistemological black hole where we can never agree on anything that ever happened, you know? So I think it's helpful to just have a broad panorama of what happened in the past that is generally agreed upon. And then you can let the experts argue about the specifics. And then eventually sometimes a new consensus comes out. So it progresses very much the way that any other science progresses. And that's kind of what I try to do with my writings, is get people to say, like, okay, look, you don't have to memorize every date. You don't have to know every name. I just want to give you this panorama and give you enough depth that you can go deeper if you want to, just to kind of whet your appetite and turn you on, you know, light the fire of learning so that you will be incentivized to go look at these other resources and get deeper into it.
That's right. And I mean, I think as well, there's something about distance from events as well, which I was interested in what you said there about a consensus arriving. I'm sure you know that, for example, in the English Reformation, it was something which was, as I say, with Belloc and co, they were debating it backwards and forwards. But today, maybe 400 or 500 years after it, there is a consensus that it was a top-down revolution. It was a revolution led by an elite, the king and his crown and his nobles, imposed upon a people who wanted to remain Catholic. And there was various revolts against this by the ordinary Catholic people. And these things were played down. And the official history was that England was very glad to throw off the yoke of Rome and set out on its own world empire and all the rest of it, the sort of Whiggish version of history. Whereas I don't think there's any historians, British, American or otherwise, who would say actually that's how it was. So do you think that's true, that after a while there is a kind of consensus which is more objective?
I think there is, and it definitely happens over time. And one thing that's interesting is I've written books on modern history, and I've always been mystified that a lot of textbooks I would look at, like books for Catholic schools or whatever, when they deal with modern history, they will often end after World War II. And I'd had a chance to ask some of the authors, why do you end your book after World War II? And they'll say, well, the modern history is still too contentious. It's still unsettled. People, no matter what you say, people are going to disagree with your interpretation of it. So I prefer to just not write. You know, we got to wait till this is more in the past. I don't think World War II is, I think that's a bit too far back. I mean, I write in my textbooks, when I write modern history, I typically will go up to, you know, the turn of the millennium. And then if I'm writing further than that, I will make caveats saying, like, this is still being discussed, or we're still seeing the implications of this or whatever. But it's very interesting. And you mentioned that Whig version of history in the United States, or actually in any English speaking country, we've inherited a narrative of like the evil Spaniards. Where kind of like the Spaniards are cruel and devious and barbaric, and we've inherited that, and that's something that came from the Elizabethan era and the fear of the fear of a Catholic resurgence. It was Elizabethan propaganda, and I'm very glad to see that that narrative, now that we're moving away from that era, there's a much more balanced view of the Spaniards and their role in things in that time of history. So yeah, sometimes as time moves, you get a reassessment of these things and you get to a more objective view. And, you know, we should all be glad about that, even if the view isn't, you know, as easy to understand, or, you know, even if it doesn't make our side look as good sometimes, you know, it doesn't matter. The history doesn't care what you think, is what I tell people. The history doesn't care what you think. It just is. And the best thing we can do is try to understand it as objectively as possible.
Wonderful. I'm in conversation with Philip Campbell, who's an author and historian. And if you have any questions for him on the nature of history or any aspect of history, because he covers the whole of civilization, then feel free to call us 888-928-0881 or text me 251-928-2111. And when we come back, we'll be discussing salvation history as well from a Catholic perspective. And also the fact that Philip on his website has a webinar coming up with a British point of view for the American Revolution. Yes, that's right. Stay tuned to the Telly Frequency here on Archangel Radio. Welcome back to the Turley Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Turley, and I'm in conversation with Philip Campbell, who is an author, historian, publisher, media personality. I'm running out of things to say about you, Philip. You do it all, right?
Well, I guess I've dabbled in a lot of things.
You're also a husband and a father, which is probably the most important thing of all, as well as a faithful son of the church. Now, talking of the church, in conversations with a Catholic historian, I often find that there's a different emphasis because we believe in salvation history, not just a sort of objective, random series of events. Is that your view too?
Is it my view that salvation history is a thing?
Well, that perhaps there isn't a random series of events, but that there is a deep meaning to everything that has happened and is happening in history.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. I think if you're a serious Catholic, you can't take history as just a random assortment of events. Salvation history is the idea that history itself is the stage upon which, like, the drama of our salvation unfolds, that God reveals himself and our salvation unfolds through the events of human history. And it's one thing I love about Christianity is that it's a historical religion, that if you ask what is at the heart of Christianity, I mean, obviously we have all our beliefs, we have rituals, we have our morality, all these things, but what is Christianity at its heart? It's the belief at a certain point in history, something specific happened, that a man who lived 2,000 years ago was actually the Son of God and that he raised from the dead. I mean, that's the heart of Christianity, that St. Paul says, if you don't believe this, your faith is actually in vain, because this is the foundation stone of the whole thing, that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. So that's like the centerpiece of salvation history. And all of human history becomes this stage where the story of grace unfolds. And so I think if you're a Catholic historian, you have to take that into consideration. Now, we obviously have to be very careful about, not assuming that we know the mysteries of divine providence and why things happen the way they do. You know, if you're an Englishman, the victory at Agincourt in 1415 is an act of divine providence. You know, and if you're a Frenchman, the victories of Joan of Arc are divine providence driving the English out, but they're both in the same war, you know? So it's like, if you're English, it's like God's helping us. And if you're French, God's helping us, you know? So I try to understand that God's behind these things, but I'm very humble and restrained about trying to assert that I know what the divine will is doing at any given point. And I think that's probably the best thing we can do, but definitely there is some sort of, I don't know, sometimes though, it seems like you look at things and it seems so obvious. Like we're in July now, and there's going to be the Feast of St. Ignatius of Loyola coming up here on the 31st. And of course, Ignatius, the only reason that he founded the Jesuits and became a saint was because a stray cannonball hit him in the leg at a battle.
That's right.
and ruined his military career, you know? And you have to wonder about those things. Like, it's almost providential, you know, that these things happen. There's so many things throughout history where just some little turn of events happens. As I recall at the battle where King James II was defeated and lost the throne of England, as I recall, he retreated from the battle because he had a nosebleed and he wanted to attend to his nosebleed. And it's like, what's going on there? You know, there's so many little things. I wish I could pull back the curtain and understand the providence, but I think it's evident that God's behind these things and that we have to keep it in mind.
It's interesting you reference the Battle of the Boyne was where James II was defeated. And today is the day in the north of Ireland amongst Protestants that they celebrate that famous victory. So it's very interesting you say that. The only problem, as we both know, Philip, it's today. Well, I think it was fought on the 1st of July. No, it was fought today. It was fought today and they celebrated today.
Wow.
So you've just referenced it very, very nicely, very aptly on radio. But as we both know, and I know in particular, having grown up in that part of the world, that history can become myth and it can become also propaganda. And then you're into a whole different ballgame. Now, if anybody out there has a question for Philip, you can hear he's an absolutely fascinating man and has a reach of history from the dawn of civilization right up to today, the extinction of civilization or whatever we're living through. You can call him on 888-928-0881 with your questions, or text me on 251-928-2111. And I believe we have a caller online one. We've got Michelle.
Hi, this is Michelle Macklin, the executive producer of the Turley Frequency. How are you, Philip?
Oh, hi. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. How are you, Kevin? Are you doing all right?
I'm doing the best I can under the circumstances.
There we go. I have a question for Philip. Now, I am a canon lawyer, and one of the things that to be a good canon lawyer, you absolutely have to know the history that the institutional church has had to basically go through, has had to transgress through history. You have to know that, and you have to know it cold because it affects the human institution. In your studies of history, how do you think history, and this may be a very, very broad question, affects the individual life of the ancient people and the modern people? I think we talk about the burden of history. I live in Germany, where it very much is the burden of history. What is sort of your viewpoint on that?
On how a given people's history affects their psyche?
Right, their psyche and their actions, because I know how history affects the institutional church. Sometimes, and I'm not talking about the Church of the Holy Spirit, it's all one, but there's definitely an institutional church. And I see how the institutional church reacts to history. I can see it today with Pope Francis right now, and he is reacting to, you know, a legacy of the last two popes. He's also reacting to, you know, environmentalism, to globalism, to these historic trends. How do you see that?
Yeah, well, no matter. So, like, I wrote a book about the history of the Philippines. And the Philippines has an interesting history where they have an indigenous history, and then they have a history as a Spanish colony for 300 years, and then they were an American colony for 50 years. And they drew something from each of those experiences. And today in the Philippines, modern-day Filipinos, there's this great kind of cultural debate about what they're supposed to do about, like, their Spanish heritage. Like, Filipinos are some of the most devoutedly Catholic people on the planet. Their mass attendance there is something like 90%, and they're very devout. But also, Catholicism was something they received through colonization, which is also perceived to be a negative experience in their history. So there's some people there that say, well, we need to repudiate our colonial past and try to discover a pure Filipino identity. And then there's others that say, no, this is who we wouldn't be who we are. The Spaniards made us a nation. We wouldn't even exist without it. And so I thought about this a lot, and, like, to what degree can people separate themselves from their historical heritage or from the mindsets they inherit? In a certain sense, you can't. Just like I'm part Sicilian and part Scottish, and I can't change that. I can't get it out of my DNA. It's just what I am, you know? And I think historically we can't make ourselves not have the history that we have or the cultural influences that we have. We can be aware of them, you know, and we can maybe choose to act differently, but we can't really get away from them. And whether we like it or not, we're all born with, you said you came from Northern Ireland. You probably have certain experiences, certain worldview that was just shaped from that milieu of growing up there. And you can be aware of it, but it's probably very difficult to just divest yourself of it entirely. So I think it affects the way that we view the world. It affects the way that we view other people. It affects the way that, you know, we view national relations or the church, whatever. And it's hard to get away from, but the best thing is probably to just be aware of it. Sometimes I have opinions or I see things and I recognize, like, oh, that's my American bias of being grown up in the United States in the Midwest. Like, that's an opinion that I've imbibed by osmosis of just living in this milieu and, you know, and being around many people who share similar views. And I try to be aware of that. That's not to say that it's wrong, not to say that it's right, but we just have to at least take it into consideration and try to bring those things before reason and before divine revelation and try to conform ourselves to I think the bigger truth. So it is a very big, question. And I can imagine in Germany that the past must be something that's very, very burdensome. And I imagine that there's probably difficulty grappling with it.
There is. And I tell you, it's not just Germany. It's also in the United States. One of the problems, I just heard of something recently at the National Portrait Gallery in the Smithsonian up in Washington, D.C. They did a history of the Civil War without mentioning any of the Confederates or the Confederate generals. So how do you do that? And if we erase history, then I think we become less than ourselves.
I profoundly disagree with. Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree more strongly with that. With erasing history, that's just, I don't know, that's simply wrong. The way we come to terms with historical problems is to understand the history, you know, and to learn it. And we can't learn it if we're erasing it or if we're afraid of it. We can't be afraid of our history. We simply have to face it. It doesn't need to be a burden. You know, I mean, I know there's still ongoing problems, especially with the, you know, racial history in the United States. But it's something we just simply have to face. You know, I don't see what is served by not mentioning people, you know, who were part of the history. That seems insane to me.
It is insane. And
that seems like propaganda, not history.
Right. It's Orwellian, actually. It's very Orwellian in the end. I really encourage people to really read church history, because the history of the Roman Catholic Church is, you have everything there. You have institutional history. You have salvation history. You have political history. You have your cultural history. I mean, it is a fantastic organization because of its history that's been both good and bad. So anyway, thank you for letting me take questions and or let me ask questions. And Kevin?
No, pleasure. Absolute pleasure, Michelle.
Okay,
thank you so
thanks.
Much for coming on and raising the tone. That was a very interesting discussion. I think you'll agree, Philip. Now, I have to ask you, are you seriously proposing the British point of view for the Revolutionary War?
Well, first thing, that webinar actually happened last year, so that's from last year. But the good news about that is the webinar is now online, and if you go to my YouTube channel, which is Mr. Campbell Explains, I have uploaded that whole lecture. It's an hour and a half long, and so in the United States, we only get basically the colonial viewpoint of the Revolutionary War. We are taught, you know, what the founding fathers thought, how they assessed the situation. And so I thought it would be really interesting to see, you know, I mean, the Revolutionary War went on for, you know, 8 years or so. It'd be interesting to see what the British public thought about all this. What was the Parliament arguing during this time? And so this webinar takes a look at kind of like how the British viewed the events in the New World. And I think it puts a lot of perspective in what happened. I found it very interesting. And I found out that Catholicism was involved in this. There was when the war was faltering, King George proposed to enlist Catholics into the ranks of the British military, which had up to that time not been done. And there was a lot of resistance to this. There was riots called the Gordon Riots throughout London, where there was like a huge anti-papist rally where people were rioting, not wanting to allow papists into the military because they thought it would undermine the stability of the British army. And they had to call out the regulars to put down this revolt. And it was very unpopular. And it just was one of the things that contributed to Parliament saying, okay, we have to end this war because it's starting to turn into civil unrest at home in England. And I was never taught that here in the States. Taught about like anti-Catholic riots in England during the Revolutionary War connected to the war effort. So there's a lot of interesting little tidbits that most Americans never learn about.
Well, on this show, actually, Philip, we did the Gordon Riots. We spent two shows going through them, because the other impact they had, you probably know, is that they influenced negotiations with both Spain and Austria in their support or possible entry into the American Revolutionary War. And you could make a very cogent case that the Gordon Riots and the way that they represented anti-Catholicism here in England, they cast a shadow across diplomacy in Europe and helped the American American revolutionaries. But that's a whole different program. Listen, we're almost out of time, Philip. You're the sort of guy I could talk to for the next 2 hours, but I'm afraid the producers would just cut us off sooner rather than later. Tell people where they can find out more about you, about your writings, and about all your wonderful books.
Yep, all of my books are available on Amazon. I have some from multiple companies. If you want to see a comprehensive list of what I'm doing and all my works, visit me online at philipcampbell.net, or you can follow me on Facebook at Philip Campbell Author Teacher to stay abreast of current progress.
Philip, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. I hope we meet again and in not too distant future.
Me too. I'd be happy to come back.
That's great. Okay, we're going to be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet next, so stay tuned to the Charlie Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio.